Welcome to Women in Translation, an audio series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more. In this episode, host Andrew Singer speaks remotely with Austrian author Anna Goldenberg and translator Alta Price about the book I Belong to Vienna, recounting Anna's family journey from Austria to the US in World War II, and more. This book is published by New Vessel Press. This episode has been made possible with kind support from the Austrian Cultural Forum in New York. Andrew begins by asking Anna Goldenberg how she came to write this book.
It's a longer story. So I don't only belong to Vienna, I come from Vienna, which is where I was born and raised, and I come from a Jewish family. And that was something that has never played a really big role in my life. Like I knew I was Jewish, I knew I was a minority, I knew my grandparents were Holocaust survivors, and we talked about their stories. But that was about it, more or less. And then, fast forward to 2012, when I moved to the US, to New York, to study journalism at Columbia Journalism School. And that was when people started asking me questions about where I came from. And they were like, oh, so you're, they heard my accent and they were like, where are you from? Because they couldn't quite place it. And I was like, I'm from Austria. And then they were like, sometimes we're like, oh, I don't know, don't even know where that is. And especially when they were Jewish or knew a lot about history, they became quite like suspicious and were like, oh, Austria, isn't it all Nazis and everything? And then I was like, I don't want to get into that discussion. I was like, you know, but I'm Jewish. Like my grandparents didn't kill your grandfather, more or less. But that was when people got really, really, upset and started asking all those questions, like, you're Jewish and how come you're still in, Austria? And what about your grandparents? And what did they do during the war? And did they leave? And did they come back? And how did they survive? And I would just, you know, find myself really like vividly remember having at the rooftop party in Brooklyn, in the middle of the night with beer and barbecue and having to, like, during the course of small talk, explain to people how my grandmother survived the Holocaust. So that was when I felt like that's a story people are interested about. That's something they want to hear. So I started writing about it because I wanted to be a journalist. So I wrote about this. And then when I moved back to Vienna in 2015, I'll make the story short. I wrote a story about grandfather that attracted the interest of a publisher, which is how the book came about.
Sort of
my whole interest was triggered by noisy questions by Americans.
The coming of age experience is often one of coming to get greater curiosity about one's roots. And I spent my young adulthood abroad, actually in Europe, and I had a lot of questions. But it doesn't always lead to writing a book, you know. So you went the extra distance with this as a journalist and a writer, and we all benefit from that experience. So we will listen to some passages from this book in a moment, both in German and Alta with you in English. But first, Anna, can you kind of give an overview of this story? Can you introduce it to us in some deeper way here?
Sure. So I'm telling the story, I'm actually telling two stories of my grandmother and my grandfather, both on the maternal side. And they are roughly the same age, and they're both from Jewish Viennese families, but they only met after the war. So that's always important for me to point out. My grandmother, Helga, she was, had a very, you know, lovely childhood in Vienna with a younger sister and her mother and her father. And she was deported to Theresienstadt, the concentration camp, in 1943, when she was 14, together with her mother and her younger sister. Her father at this point had already fled to Italy. That's another story I'll leave out for now. So she spent 2 years in that camp and survived. My grandmother is still alive. So a lot of I talked to her and interviewed her, and we even went to Theresienstadt together. So that's all part of the book, my conversations and how she remembers it and what that visit was like. And then the second story I'm telling is the story of my grandfather, Henri, who's a few years older than my grandmother. He was born in 1925 in Vienna. And so Hansi went to school, but he wasn't a very good student and he didn't really like to follow rules and everything. Which was probably a reason why the school doctor, started looking after him, because he was really interested in, you know, kids that were a bit different, a bit complicated, but certainly smart. And this school doctor was called Josef Feldner. Everyone called him Peppy, because Joseph in Austrian is often abbreviated as Peppy. And in 1942, when Hansi's family, he had parents and a younger brother, got this yellow postcard that said that they should go to the camp. And Pepe suggested to the parents that he could hide the two boys in his flat. At this point, Hansi was 17. And the parents decided that Hansi should go with Pepe and the younger brother would come with them. And that's how my grandfather survived the war, in hiding for 2.5 years in Vienna. I won't go into too much details. You have to read the book.
Right, you have to read the book. It's a fascinating story, and a layered account, because you're also telling about your research and how you came to know the story. Perhaps the best way to introduce this is for us to hear a bit from the very beginning of the book. I mean, this passage titled Poughkeepsie, New York, 2013. So why don't we hear an excerpt from that, firstly a bit in German from you, Anna, and then the longer passage read in English by translator Alta L. Price.
Poughkeepsie, New York, 2013. Fotografieren verboten. Der breitschultrige Sicherheitsmann in der dunkelblauen Jacke klingt bestimmt, aber höflich und mustert mich kurz. Ich habe gar nicht bemerkt, dass er sich mir genähert hat. So vertieft bin ich, die Eingangshalle des Krankenhauses zu fotografieren. Es steht in Poughkeepsie, im Norden des Bundesstaates New York. Auf den Bänken sitzen einige Menschen. Die Wand hinter der Rezeption, einem länglichen mintgrünen Tresen, ist ziegelrot gestrichen. Die gläserne Eingangstür surrt, wenn sie sich öffnet. Ich lasse mein Smartphone, das ich auf das riesige Fenster zum Parkplatz gerichtet habe, sinken und stecke es in die Manteltasche, etwas eingeschüchtert. Der Sicherheitsmann dreht sich weg, sichtlich beruhigt. Die Gefahr hat er abgewendet. Ich fasse Mut und spreche ihn an. Ob es jemanden gäbe, der mir weiterhelfen könnte, historische Personalakten zu finden? Er scheint verwundert, überlegt kurz und führt mich in die wie ausgestorben wirkende Spitalsbibliothek, wo ich von einer Bibliothekarin enthusiastisch begrüßt werde.
Poughkeepsie, New York, 2013. No photos. The broad-shouldered security guard in a dark blue jacket sounds firm yet polite as he gives me the once-over. I am so focused on taking a picture of the hospital's entrance hall that I didn't even notice him approaching. I'm in Poughkeepsie, in the Hudson Valley, north of New York City. A few people are waiting on benches, and the wall behind the reception desk, an oblong, mint-green counter, is painted brick red. The main glass door whirs when it opens. I lower my smartphone, which I had pointed toward the huge window overlooking the parking lot, and put it in my coat pocket, a bit intimidated. The guard turns away, visibly reassured to have warded off a threat. I summon the courage to ask him, is there anyone who might help me locate some old personnel files? He seems puzzled, thinks for a second, and leads me to the virtually empty hospital library, where I'm enthusiastically greeted by a librarian. Back in the 50s, two young doctors from Vienna worked at this hospital, I tell her. They were interns, what we'd call residents today, and spent a year serving various departments. I'm now looking for documents, references, maybe old rosters, anything that might tell me more about their time here. The librarian replies that she'll gladly look into it, visibly flattered by the provincial hospital's international reputation. What are their names? Helga and Hans Feldner Bustin. She disappears into a back room. 5 minutes later, she's back. No, unfortunately, they aren't in any of the old files. I'm so clearly disappointed that she asks why I'm interested. They're my grandparents. That evening, I take the train some 90 miles back to New York City, downcast that no one here remembers my grandparents. After all, my grandmother Helga spoke of their stay here so often. In her bedroom, there's even a newspaper clipping from 1955 hanging on the wall from a Jewish American newspaper. The photo shows a smiling young couple. Helga is 26, Hansi 29. Quote, also aboard the Saturnia were doctors Hans and Helga Feldner-Bustin, who came from Vienna to intern at Poughkeepsie Hospital. Dr. Helga was liberated from Nazi concentration camp in 1945. Dr. Hans said his brother and parents perished in concentration camp, but he escaped when a Christian doctor adopted him, unquote. The two had arrived in the States still fairly undecided. They knew they'd definitely stay there a year, they said, and then they could see how they liked it. Due to the shortage of doctors in the United States, Helga was immediately given demanding work in Poughkeepsie, unlike the Viennese hospital where she had worked as an assistant doctor for the previous 2.5 years. The salary was good, too. Hansi had previously been an unpaid visiting physician at a neurological clinic in Vienna and had only earned pay for overnight services. In Poughkeepsie, they could even afford a car, which they shared with two other doctors. And yet by April 1956, they had gone back to Vienna, where they spent the rest of their lives. I only began to wonder why when I moved to the United States myself. In the summer of 2012, I started my master's degree in New York City. I was just 23, a bit younger than my grandmother had been back then. New York had fascinated me since my teenage years, of course, because it had been the backdrop for pivotal scenes in so many movies. Here, Woody Allen had been funny in a way I had long enjoyed. Here, shy Spider-Man saved people from all sorts of villains. Here, despite all adversities, the heroes of the rom-coms I adored invariably found each other. With its various neighborhoods, cultures, and broad range of possibilities, the city was so visibly diverse that I was convinced I could make a place for myself here. Like my grandparents, I'd stay for a year and then see how I liked it.
That was first Anna Goldenberg in German, then Alta Price in English, reading from the beginning of Anna's book, I Belong to Vienna, available from New Vessel Press. The initial chapter here, Anna goes on to detail some of what you've just been telling us about, of what first motivated you and how you came first to research your family in New York. Can you say a bit more about this research process? What was that like for you?
It was a lot of fun. So one part included, as I mentioned before, interviewing my grandmother, which I enjoyed because we're on very good terms. And she's also very used to speaking about this period of her life. She's now 91. And if it weren't Corona times, she would be visiting schools and talking about her experiences. So it's not, you know, she's not one of those survivors who stayed silent for their entire lives, but she's used to it, which is sometimes it was tricky sometimes. Because she's so also so used to telling some of her stories, it was difficult to dig deeper, if you know what I mean. She would tell the same stories over and over again, and if I wanted to hear it from a different angle, that was difficult. Also, it was so many years ago.
This book is in the form of a memoir. Carl Jung, in the prologue to his autobiographical book, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, says that he can only, quote, tell stories. Whether or not the stories are true is not the problem, he says. The only question is whether what he tells is his truth, his personal myth. Anna, to what extent is this book, I Belong to Vienna, a record of literal truth, versus to what extent is it crafted as a literary work?
Well, I tried to stick with the facts, but it was just really difficult to find them all because I was really late. I was at least 30, if not 50 years too late to actually be telling my grandparents' stories, because other than my grandmother and her sister, there wasn't really anyone else alive who was there who could tell me, who could just confirm. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm used to rely on multiple sources and check and double check and recheck, and that wasn't possible. So what I tried to do is research everything to make sure it was at least plausible. So when my grandmother told me, I don't know, for example, about the type of work she did at the camp, I did research if there was actually that type of work there. Not that I distrust my grandmother, but it'd been 60 years and she's been reading a lot on the topic, and you know, she has a huge historical knowledge, so that can sometimes mix with her memory.
Was there a lot of travel involved in researching this book, and how long did it take you to write?
I researched and wrote the book over a period of 3 years, and there were some breaks in between where I was doing other stuff, and it was really good to have that much time. My Austrian publisher was very, very generous, because it really needed the time to grow. Travel? No, not a whole lot. I traveled to a lot of archives in Vienna, because I did try to find anything, any sort of official documents that were still there around my family's history. I didn't find an awful lot, but I did find some things.
Were there elements of the overall structure or writing of the book which evolved as you deepened in this process? Or was it all clear from the beginning how you would lay it out?
I think the structure was clear. I knew I wanted to tell the story chronologically, and that I wanted to have both my grandparents and my own experience in the U.S. as sort of a frame in the beginning and in the end. But throughout the writing and researching and editing process, what changed a lot was sort of how those different parts were tied together. I do remember in my very first version, I just put in all the historical knowledge I had gained while doing the research. And then my publisher was like, you're like every journalist who first writes a book. You're so happy you have all that space. You just write everything in. So I cut everything out. And then they were like, oh, well, that's too little. You need some more flesh. and so it went back and forth until in the end, like, I'm quite happy with the mixture.
Like the story of Goldilocks, this book is too large, this book is too small, and so on. I think a great way for us to proceed now is to get another passage to hear some of this color that you've managed to write about their experiences in the time of the war and so on. There's a passage called Neubaugasse, and I think, Anna, perhaps you can read a paragraph from the middle of this, and then Alta, you can read this whole section in English.
The one with the magic flute. Die Ouvertüre der Zauberflöte soll sein. Um mich herum sind viele Touristen. Ich erkenne vertraute Melodien und bin dem ungeliebten Musiklehrer dankbar, dass wir Opern wie diese hörten. Und er uns erklärte, dass die Musik Teil der Wiener Geschichte und Kultur sei. Ich gehöre zu Wien, also gehört die Musik zu mir, denke ich, und vermute, dass Hansi Ähnliches spürte. Das Verbot für Juden, Theater, Kinos und Konzerte zu besuchen, kam am 12. November 1938. Der Ausschluss vom Kulturleben bedeutete, nicht mehr Teil eines verbindenden großen Ganzen zu sein. In der Oper gehörte Hansi weiter dazu. Die Zauberflöte sah zweimal, am 10. Mai 1943 und ziemlich genau ein Jahr später, am 14. Mai 1944.
Neubaugasse. In the winter of 1942, Pepi was given a ticket for a performance at the Vienna State Opera and passed it on to Hansi. At that first performance, Hansi discovered two things, his love of opera and cheap standing room tickets. The next evening, he went right back, bought a ticket for 70 pfennigs, and saw Aida while leaning against the railing of the fourth floor balcony. He kept going regularly, often several times a week. He had never cared about opera before. Nobody in his family had been musically inclined, either. But now he couldn't get enough. It became part of his everyday life. He was often among the first in line when the standing section tickets went on sale each afternoon. The program during the Nazi period wasn't very different from the years before and after. In addition to Wagner and Beethoven, Italian composers like Verdi and Puccini were popular. Hansi saw Madame Butterfly and La Bohème at least 8 times each, Tosca at least 6, and La Traviata at least 5. Soon, he knew the various singers' strengths and weaknesses, and he leaned even farther over the railing as he applauded their particularly successful parts. He read their names in the printed program, which cost about 50 pfennigs, then carefully folded the piece of paper lengthwise and saved it in a folder at home. If there were substitutions, he wrote in the understudies by hand. If he didn't have enough money for the program, he noted the date, opera title, and singers of the main roles on a piece of paper and added it to his collection, which by the end of the war consisted of 117 programs. I find the stash in a gray cardboard folder in his old study. I slip the thin, double-sided programs into transparent sheet protectors, sort them into chronological order, and put them in a three-ring binder. As I leaf through the portfolio, it occurs to me that I just might be holding Hansi's most precious private possession from that period. The programs cost almost as much as the tickets themselves. They're like a diary, pieces of evidence proving his existence. More than a year later, in winter 2016, I decide to go to the opera myself. I've hardly been interested in the genre since the last music class I took back in high school. The teacher, watching us vigilantly, would have us follow the notes of piano excerpts. He'd stalk through the room as some opera burst forth from the speakers, then suddenly stop behind one of us students. If you had your finger on the right page, or, better yet, the right bar, he'd move on. Then I went off to study in England and the United States. Now I'm back in Vienna. And just as I encountered incomprehension among the Jews of New York who wondered how my family could ever live in Austria, people now routinely tell me how inexplicable they find it that I moved back to Vienna after 3 years in New York. I had a job, after all, a job in journalism, and a work visa. I hem and haw and indulge in all the comparative cliches. The quality of life is so much better in Vienna. Everything just moves so fast in New York. Sometimes I respond by talking about the stingy landlady who refused to turn the heat up in winter, or the Jewish weekly where I worked. For the most part, it was great. But did I really always want to write about the same topics? Or the time zone difference that made it so difficult to connect with friends and family in Europe by phone? I'd tell people I'm working on this book and prefer to be close to the places I'm writing about. I gave the same vague answers I had back in New York when people asked why my grandparents had decided to spend their lives in Vienna after the war. But now those are all just excuses. I know the real answer, but I'm ashamed to admit it. In New York, I was lonelier than I'd ever been before. Sure, it wasn't hard to keep busy and constantly meet new people. I even got used to eating alone more often. But I missed the family I had grown up in. From the uppermost standing section at the Vienna State Opera, I look out across the entire auditorium. Music lovers appreciate the acoustics up here. Perhaps both of these aspects were among the reasons Hansi liked being here. Spots in the standing section on the ground floor cost a little more, too, a full Reichsmark instead of 70 Pfennigs. How dangerous was it for Hansi to go to the opera? In the event of a raid, making an inconspicuous escape would have been impossible. My grandfather writes that no one ever asked for his papers at the opera. Was he just lucky enough to not be there during a raid, or was the opera never subject to such searches? The police checked IDs in all sorts of places and would cordon off the entire area until they were done. Movie theaters were frequent targets for such raids, which is why Hansi avoided them throughout the war. But what about the opera? Hansi writes that many performances were almost exclusively reserved for various Nazi affiliate organizations, and the only tickets sold to the public were for the standing sections. The audience was always swarming with uniformed men. Maybe that's why the authorities didn't bother with raids there. The overture to the Magic Flute begins. I'm surrounded by tourists. I recognize familiar melodies and am grateful my strict old music teacher had us listen to operas like this and explained how music is such an integral part of Viennese history and culture. The thought occurs to me. I belong to Vienna, so this music belongs to me, too. And I suspect Hansi felt the same. Jews were banned from theaters, movies, and concert halls on November 12, 1938. Their exclusion from cultural life meant they were no longer part of a unified whole. At the opera, Hansi belonged again. He saw the Magic Flute twice, on May 10, 1943, and almost exactly a year later, on May 14, 1944. After a few weeks, Hansi noticed several other men of military age on the fourth floor balcony who, like him, weren't in uniform. How did they have time to go to the opera? Were there other people in hiding among his fellow regulars? He didn't dare ask. The only interactions we had were all about music, he writes. During performances, they would comment on the singing through glances and gestures. During intermission, they would talk about the singers, the conductor, and the sets. They seemed to have an unspoken agreement that their particular living conditions and everything else that existed outside that grand building on Vienna's Ringstrasse remained cloaked in silence.
That was first author Anna Goldenberg reading a short passage in German, and then translator Alta Price reading a longer passage from I Belong to Vienna. All of this talk of the Vienna State Opera motivates me to want to listen to some music. We haven't got any opera here, but here's a short selection performed by the Vienna State Opera Orchestra in 1958. It's a section from Mozart's Te Deum. Back. I'm Andrew Singer. This is Women in Translation, a series of Trafica Europe Radio, and we're joined on this episode by author Anna Goldenberg from Austria and her translator Alta Price in the U.S., all of us locked down in this time of pandemic, and talking about Anna's book, with the English title of which is I Belong to Vienna, coming just out with New Vessel Press. Anna, this was a pretty complex and moving passage that you just read. What are your thoughts now listening to it at this remove?
It sounds beautiful in English. This is what I was thinking. And yeah, it's like a vital part of the book, because it's been something I've known my entire life. It has been part of family history and has been passed on as a story and has been something we've been telling other people. And so it felt really, really important for me to include this and find out as much about it as possible, because the fact that a Jew in hiding would go to the opera several times a week for I think 2 years is just so unbelievable.
Sometimes there's some veiled criticism woven into the offhand way that some of it is covered. For example, the line, for me, the program during the Nazi period wasn't very different from the years before and after at the Vienna State Opera. I mean, that's a little bit devastating to hear.
To the Nazis, yeah. I did speak to a great researcher here in Vienna about this, because I wanted to find out more about it. And I was personally somehow disappointed that opera during Nazi time wasn't that different, and that was because their racial ideology just couldn't be applied to music. It just didn't fit, because did it mean that they only allowed so-called Aryan composers, or would they only allow so-called Aryan music, and they couldn't really decide on what Aryan music would be. So what they did is they just kicked out music by Jewish composers, and that was really, too progressive, and then just continued with the old program. And that's how they continued after the war. And as I mentioned in that passage, what Hansi watched then is still on the program of the opera today.
Alta, the rendering in English is beautiful. What are some of the issues you encountered, either in terms of the language or the history or the references or how it's all layered together? What issues did you have in translating this?
So that's always a fascinating question, because my instinct says, you know, I'm just the translator. It's, you know, I think the rigorous research and the journalistic rigor behind this that Anna did is very clear. And, you know, my main goal is to bring this marvelous and incredibly moving text into English. But then, you know, as soon as you dig down into the details, of course, interesting questions come up. And I think, so I first want to point out, actually, for all of our listeners, both, you know, listeners who maybe know German or know English or know both, that the stark, you know, clear difference between the original title, Versteckte Jahre, and I Belong to Vienna. So, you know, and this is something where I feel very lucky, first of all, to have discovered this book, you know, while I was actually on a translation fellowship in Vienna, to have discovered the German and then have to successfully placed it with a US publisher. And of course, there's always an issue of, it's hard to talk about translation without talking about fidelity or concepts of what it means to be faithful. So, and it's interesting, I actually keep meaning to ask Anna how she feels about this title shift, because it's very frequent that titles especially have to shift, or either translators or editors or publishers choose to shift a title. So the, you know, if I do a direct translation of the original title, it would be Hidden Years, The Man Who Saved My Grandfather. And then in English, we have I Belong to Vienna, A Jewish Family's Story of Exile and Return. So that, I mean, that points, I think, to slight adjustments for a different readership.
Anna, what do you have to say about that? Because you said something intriguing at the very beginning of our talk here. You said that you don't actually belong to Vienna. How do you feel about this English title and how it shifts the focus of the work or the perspective of it?
I like it because I had quite a few issues with the German title, because it's so focused on just my grandfather's story, and everyone who reads the book knows that it's pretty much, it's split evenly between my grandfather and my grandmother. So I do like I Belong to Vienna, because it summarizes all three storylines, my grandfather, my grandmother, and myself.
I appreciate that. I was hesitant at first as well, in, you know, wanting to absolutely honor the original, but also, so I encourage listeners, first of all, before I forget, I want to point out that there are some wonderful video clips of Anna reading from the original. Anna, correct me if I'm wrong, I think those are on the publisher's website.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Scholnai Verlag. And you read it so wonderfully. And then you can also, and Andrew, if you can include, I don't know, on your website, the two different covers. Because what's interesting to me is it really says a lot about translation. You know, it's exactly the same book, and yet because it's reaching a new readership and a new generations and readers in a different geographic location and culture, it's taking on a new life. So I guess I just want to say I'm incredibly grateful to think that I had some small role in bringing this to new readers. I also, in terms of the translation, there are, Anna, you mentioned the racial ideology of the Nazis and their program at the opera. And I think one of the strongest parts of this specific section that we just read points to the absurd inconsistency of the Nazi regime. And this is one of the big points in this book, is that, you know, they had these myths of Ordnung and, you know, everything being organized and rigorously carried out. And but there's really just the absurdity and chaos underlying it all is very clear throughout. Other translation issues, correct me if I'm wrong with this, I have this memory that, is it U-Boot, Jüdische U-Boot? Does that ring a bell? At a certain point in the original text, the literal translation would be that there were really Jewish people had to become submarines. which in English, you know, we say that you go underground. You're living in hiding, you go underground. So small shifts in register like that. And which reminds me, I think it's really important to point out, and you talk about this in other parts of the book, that this is, to me, to my mind, to my thinking, a very unique story, in that your grandfather was in hiding, but at the same time, he was out and about. He was out on the streets. And that's where a lot of the tension and action in the book comes from, that he's living in hiding, but he's able to circulate in public. So it's a very different story than, say, the Diary of Anne Frank. It's important to emphasize for our listeners today that it's a very unique story, and that Hansi is out in public. So that's another interesting aspect to the German title versus the English title, is that yes, he was living in hiding. He was, you know, as in English, we would say he had gone underground, and yet at the same time, he's out and about in society, in public, still hidden, but, you know, survives through the war. And it's just so, Andrew mentioned earlier about, you know, potentially did Anna have to make any literary embellishments? And my feeling as I translated this was that, I mean, she has clearly done so much research, but it's also just such an improbable, miraculous story, that it's just stunning. So I really hope that listeners today will pick up a copy.
Can we listen to one more segment from it? I think we talked about one later on in the book. Anna, maybe you can read a couple of paragraphs, and then Alta again, a slightly longer English passage. Thank you.
An seinen Briefen, in denen die Sprache mischt, merke ich, dass sich Hansis Englisch schnell verbesserte. Everybody speaks English to me, so dass ich beim Denken, beim Schlafen und beim Reden meine deutsche Sprache mit englischen Ausdrücken durchmische, heißt es darin kurz nach der Ankunft. Nach und nach werden Hansis englische Textteile länger und zunehmend freier von Fehlern. Er berichtet, dass er auch Romane aus der Spitalsbibliothek liest. Die Sprache kann also nicht der entscheidende Grund für ihre Rückkehr nach Wien gewesen sein, denke ich. Was war es dann? Finanziell ging es ihnen so gut wie nie zuvor. Sie lebten sparsam. Gemeinsam mit zwei anderen Interns schafften sie sich einen Gebrauchtwagen an. Das Chauffieren ließ sich Hansi von seinem Schwager, Lizis Ehemann, beibringen. Im Gegenzug half er, für ihr einstöckiges Haus auf Long Island einen Zubau für das Esszimmer zu errichten. Zur Fahrprüfung trat Hansi mit dem eigenen Auto an. Das war damals üblich. Unmittelbar nach Beginn der Prüfungsfahrt blieb das Auto liegen. Die Mitbesitzer hatten vergessen, Benzin nachzufüllen. Ein paar Wochen später trat Hansi erneut zur Prüfung an und bestand.
Many of Hansi's letters are a linguistic mixture, and rereading them, I notice how quickly his English improved. Everybody speaks English to me, so when I think, sleep, and talk, I mix German and English expressions, he writes shortly after arrival. Little by little, the English parts become longer and increasingly error-free. He reports that he also reads novels from the hospital library. Language can't have been the real reason they returned to Vienna, I think. Then what was it? Financially, they were doing better than ever before. They lived frugally. They bought and shared a used car with two other interns. Hansi's brother-in-law, Litzi's husband, taught him how to drive. In return, he helped build an addition to her one-story home on Long Island for a new dining room. Hansi showed up to the driving test with his own car, which was common at the time. Shortly after the test started, the car stopped in its tracks. The other couple they shared it with had forgotten to refill the gas tank. A few weeks later, Hansi went back to take the test a second time and passed. There is constant pressure to buy new things, Hansi writes. Therefore, many people are deep in debt. It's like they just love having gift-giving orgies over here, he writes one June after Father's Day, when his cousin Litzi gave him a shirt. Despite the fact that I'm not even a dad, he wrote. And he frantically went out to get his own uncle a gift, aftershave, at the very last minute. But by the same token, he was also fascinated by the technological innovations he was discovering, and was now able to write about them in English. Litzi got last week a new dishwasher. This is a machine in which you can put all your dishes in glasses, and then you close, and after half an hour, your dishes are clean and dry, and you must only take them out. Were my grandparents lonely and socially isolated, as one sometimes hears immigrants say? Quite the contrary. it seems they could barely say no to all the invitations. Fellow doctors and hospital employees had them over, and they went to parties and the movies. One family that had to travel for several weeks even generously let them stay in their stately home while they were away. Helga and Hansi spent most of their time in the living room, listening to records. Time and again, they had run into acquaintances from Vienna who had emigrated like them. They spent their free weekends in New York City with the family, who wanted to show them around town and help them integrate. They went to concerts, the theater, and museums, and they enjoyed lavish dinners for the Jewish holidays. Hansi appreciated his intelligent and attentive aunt, his engaged and family-oriented cousin, and his good-natured and amicable uncle. Helga's memories of Hansi's family are also very positive. In July, Hansi writes Pepe that a friendly fellow Jewish doctor invited them to go swimming at a, quote, Jewish lake, unquote. Poughkeepsie's Jews have bought their own lake. Everything here is separated. There isn't much mixing. People stay in their own little circles with others of the same social background. Helga confirms it. She had found the degree of racial segregation in particular deeply disturbing. The staff of the hospital was mixed. Their fellow interns included a black doctor, and her senior physician was black as well. On paper, New York was one of the most progressive states when it came to anti-discrimination legislation. A government commission against discrimination at work had been introduced in 1945. From 1952 onward, people could sue for unequal treatment in public places. By 1954, segregation in schools had been declared illegal nationwide. Reality was rather different, Helga learned, when one of her black colleagues gave her a lift into the center of Poughkeepsie. Helga asked if he'd like to go shopping with her. He declined, saying that he couldn't be seen beside a white woman in public. She was no less disturbed upon learning that an Austrian acquaintance who worked at the same hospital often wasn't invited when they were. Jewish doctors invited the Jewish couple, but not their non-Jewish friend. Quote, I had had enough of that during the war, says Helga. So rigid, racist social conventions certainly played a major role in their decision to return to Europe.
That was first Austrian author Anna Goldenberg and then translator Alta Price reading from I Belong to Vienna. And quite a fascinating twist here. So the story doesn't rest in the predictable way. It's not only a story of Holocaust, but it's a story of how we continue as civilizations and cultures and perhaps some of the nuanced complexity that gets lost in sometimes in these accounts. Anna, you're rendering perhaps surprising for some of our listeners aspect of racism that they experienced in the United States. Anna, you're now starting to talk about some aspects of racism and discrimination after the war in the United States, which may be a surprising element to the story for some of our listeners. I was so pleased to understand from talking with you here that it has been your strong bond with your grandmother that led you to a deeper exploration of all of this. To what extent is this information direct from your grandmother? To what extent is it based on your research or your own experience? Or how did that part of the story come to be part of this book?
It was my grandmother who had very, very strong words about that and about what she experienced with regards to racial segregation in upstate New York in the 50s. It was also my grandfather's letters that were quoted in the passage where he writes to Pepe. He wrote to Pepe several times a week, very, very quite elaborate letters. So I went through them all and got a lot of the details out of them. And then I also, obviously I also did some research around it. And then having lived in the US for almost 3 years, it all seemed very plausible to me. I remember the time I was there was right when the Black Lives Matter movement started. So it was also something, coming from Vienna that is multicultural, but not as visibly multicultural as perhaps New York. So that was something new to me and gave me a really interesting new perspective on discrimination and racism that I hadn't really known.
And a kind of journalist's vigilance in rendering the world as it is rather than how we would like it to be, perhaps. The final interesting twist in all this is that just as your grandparents went back to Europe, you kind of quote-unquote returned to Vienna. Do you want to talk about what motivated that finally?
I think it was in the passage that Alta read earlier. I mean, I just wasn't very happy in New York. I did have a job and I did find New York very exciting, but I did miss my family. I realized perhaps in some way I do actually belong to Vienna because that's, where my family was. And, you know, knowing that my grandparents' generation had lost so much of their family, like my grandfather had lost both his parents, his brother, aunts and uncles, and, had his cousins spread all over the world. You know, I sort of understood what a gift it was and how lucky I was. And that I needed to go back to Vienna and write that story.
Alta, is there anything more in this passage, for example, that we just heard that motivates you to add some insight about the translation?
You know, I, as an American, a North American, you know, U.S. born translator, it really resonated for me, just the commentary on the commercial, you know, the site, and it's only gotten, you know, much more visible since the 50s, which these letters date from. But this obsession that his idea of the orgies of gift buying and acquisition and commercial culture, and the fact that we talk so much about the American consumer more than the American citizen. And I just found that a very powerful passage. I suppose I also do want to point out that we didn't read so much from them here, but a lot of this book has so many really, really stunning letters. So that you really get these voices from the past, and they feel so contemporary to me. Anna, you mentioned earlier in our conversation today that you felt as though you were 30 or 50 years too late to speak to some of your relatives. But, you know, personally, I feel that the multiple messages in this book are so relevant today. And then finally, I suppose I'll end on this note that the chapter titles were also a delightful challenge. You know, there are aspects, and Anna and I went back and forth a little bit more with the editors of the book about things like the earlier chapter that we read from Neubaugasse. That's the name of a lane in Vienna. And the Gasse ending, you know, and frequently in my translation, you know, we can assume that English speakers will know what that Straße is, street, and certain things like that. But Gasse is less known, so there were little details like that, and the flavor of Vienna that hopefully we maintained throughout the book. And then there are roughly, the chapters aren't numbered, but there are 17 chapters, and for instance, chapter 14 is Das Ende, the end. But it's absolutely not the end of the book. It's not the end of the story. And I really appreciate, in terms of as I translated, I thought this is, Anna's writing is brilliant, how she's structured the story. It jumps back and forth in time. It weaves together multiple lives that all connect. And, you know, it really is a story where certain chapters, events come to an end, but the story itself continues.
Alas, our conversation is also about to come to an end, but Anna, I have one more brief final question for you. If you could tell us anything about the receptivity of this book in Austria, if you feel that it contributed to a conversation there, or what your experience of publishing the book in original language was.
It was great. I mean, I wrote the book and I really enjoyed the whole process of writing. And then I thought, oh, okay, you know, maybe my grandmother will read it and one or two friends. But it sold really, really well. There was a second edition. There's an English translation. I'm turning it into a movie. So I'm currently writing a script, which is also really exciting, where I have a lot more free literary freedom and, you know, making up scenes and stuff. And people reacted to it quite positively. I did hear a lot that it was very refreshing. They said it felt contemporary because it wasn't, you know, quote unquote, the same old story, but because it was my perspective, that's something people found important and interesting. And I've also been reading in a couple of schools, which I especially love because students are a very challenging audience because they're just completely honest. I think they, you know, they were quite engaged as well, because I told them, you know, family history is a good way to approach history and learn more about the past. So, you know, just go and ask your grandparents while you still can.
Anna, thank you so much for talking with us. And Alta, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Austrian author Anna Goldenberg and her translator Alta Price about the book I Belong to Vienna, published by New Vessel Press. Thanks to the Austrian Cultural Forum in New York for making this episode possible. Women in Translation is an audio series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more. This series is executive produced by Trafica Europe Radio. Please sign up at our site to stay informed about upcoming shows. Thanks for listening.